Thank you very much, Vice Chancellor. You've just given me the, or given the audience the conclusions of my lecture, so that's great.
We know where we're going.
Right. When I first came to Sussex, I knew that I was going to change my research direction. I had previously been working in America on anti-inflammatory mechanisms in blood cells, and I decided to change my research direction because this was not going to be easy at the time to do at Sussex. There wasn't a medical school here. And so I looked around for what kind of research I was going to do. And I joined a chemistry department, and I had a chat with the Dean of Molecular Sciences at that time to discuss with him what type of chemical research I could do. And he said, you can do anything you like, absolutely anything you like, but don't do synthetic chemistry. And synthetic chemistry is the synthesis of organic molecules, and I decided, well, thank goodness for that, because I don't know any synthetic chemistry. I didn't really want to do that at all. And so I went away and had a good think, and I decided to work on environmental pollution, and particularly the environmental pollution of our rivers and surface waters. It was a steep learning curve. I had never analysed an environmental chemical in my life before, although I'd analysed plenty of other types of chemicals, and I certainly knew very little about fish and river pollution. But that's the story I'm going to tell you about today in the next hour or so. So my lecture is going to include an introduction to estrogenic pollution. I'm going to talk a bit about antiandrogens in the environment, endocrine disruption and human health, and draw some conclusions on this. There's a well-known saying for people that are working on rivers. Rivers are the gutters down which flow the ruins of continents. And what that person was saying in the 1960s is that rivers originate from upland regions, and as they travel downstream, they pick up sedimentary material and particulate matter, which have arisen from the erosion of the land masses. They pick up ions and plant nutrients that arise from runoff from land, and eventually these are deposited out to sea via the estuary, and they contribute to the fertilisation of our coastal regions. And in that process of accumulating leaf litter, ions, particulates, they have developed a very interesting ecology, an ecosystem relying on microbes, invertebrates, small insects, and of course fish. Now, things go wrong, mankind comes along and contributes to the chemistry of the rivers, pouring in wastewater effluents, other types of garbage, detergents from sewage treatment and other discharges, other pollutants from mining operations, and these can cause fish kills and can also change the biology of the downstream waters so that you get increased algal growth and other changes and a lack of biodiversity. Some of the important pollutants or pollutant sources that enter rivers is sewage. And every day in the UK, we treat 11 billion litres of sewage waste. And this is most of it's discharged to rivers and about a quarter of it discharged to the sea. Now, if you're like me and you have trouble visualising what 11 billion litres looks like, if you think of the River Thames, if you think of the River Thames that flows through a number of counties. It's one of the longest rivers in the UK. It's equivalent to half the volume of water in the River Thames at any one time. So it's an awful amount of waste that we deal with on a daily basis. Now, in a river like the River Ouse, the local river in Sussex, which enters the sea at Newhaven, there are a number of sewage treatment plants, and this is typical of many of our lowland rivers, contain sewage discharges. The size of this discharge here is given here in what we call population equivalents, roughly the population that contributes to that effluent. And you can see that some discharges, this one here, discharge into the main body of the river, but other discharges are in very small tributaries that discharge into very small volumes of water. And in fact, in many of our rivers, in these streams, sewage effluent can make up from 50 to 90% of the flow of the stream. So it's almost undiluted at times in the summer. So we need to be very sure that we're treating our effluent well. And there are various ways of treating it, but essentially the major treatment process relies on microorganisms that degrade toxic chemicals like ammonia, break down detergent molecules, and break down a lot of organic material that could cause problems downstream. And some of these plants are quite small on the River Ouse, but where they're serving cities such as Manchester or parts of London, they can be very, very large. Now, that was the situation until about 20 years ago, when the Environment Agency and also some workers at Brunel University showed that below sewage effluents, even though they're well treated, there were populations of intersex roach. Now, roach is a common, what we call coarse fish, very common in lowland rivers in Europe, and it normally is either one sex or another, either male or female. What they showed was that there were individuals that contained both male and female reproductive structures. And at some sites, all the population that was examined was intersex. On the River Arun, for example, below the Horsham sewage treatment works, all the population is intersex. And they went on to show that intersex, or the incidence of intersex and its severity in the fish, was clearly correlated with the strength of the sewage effluent that was discharged into the river. Now, what does an intersex fish look like? Well, you can't tell often from the gross looking at a fish, but if you take the gonads out, the reproductive organs, and slice them thinly and put them under a microscope, stain them, you get a picture like this. You find that there is the normal male cells or tissues, which we call seminiferous tubules. They give rise to sperm. Alongside these, there's a lot of great big round structures, which are eggs in different stages of division. And in some examples where intersex is very severe, not only do you have both eggs and male structures, but there's a great big cavity, which normally you only get in females. It's called an ovarian cavity. And alongside that, you have the sperm duct, and that is either blocked or reduced. These fish are in deep trouble. And many workers have gone on to show that severely intersex fish produce no sperm at all. Moderately intersex fish produce half the sperm that they should do. the sperm quality is poor, it's not very mobile, it's not very dense, and those fish have poor fertilisation success. And modelling data indicate that if this level, at this level of intersex, many of our fish, the fish population in many of our rivers would be seriously depleted. It, in fact, it isn't, because in the case of roach, there's a lot of input. The Environment Agency restocks rivers on a fairly continual basis. So what my interest was to work on these, this type of project and ask the question, what are the culprit chemicals that cause or could be responsible for what appears to be a feminization of male fish? Now, the kind of chemicals that would feminize a fish, of course, are estrogens, feminizing hormones. If we are going to look for these compounds in sewage, we've got a challenge, because there are about 40,000 at least chemicals estimated to be in sewage. And so to find the key estrogens would be problematic, and there may not be estrogens that you would predict to find just from ordinary human waste. So we need a very simple biological test or assay to detect which effluent samples are estrogenic. And if we started to purify up the effluent sample, can we find which fractions are actually estrogenic? Now, to use that test, we need to know a little bit about how estrogenic chemicals work. So we're going to have a look at that. Now, estrogens, or estrogenic molecules, will work by binding to estrogen receptors that are located in the cytoplasm of a nucleus. And when they do that, they activate that receptor. There's a few other things that happen too. Some proteins come along and bind to that complex too. But the ultimate mechanism is that the receptor moves to the DNA, to binding sites on the DNA, and activates certain genes. And there's a number of processes that go on after that, formation of RNA and protein. But the ultimate result in terms of a fish is that you get the formation of female reproductive structures. And if it's a male fish, you form the eggs and you feminize the reproductive organs. So knowing this, we were able to get or hold of an assay which basically included this whole process, but gave us a very quick colour change that we could use for investigating sources of estrogens in the environment. And this had been developed. This assay shown here had been developed by a pharmaceutical company, Glaxo, at the time, for detecting estrogens for medical purposes. It's so we call it a genetically engineered estrogen receptor assay, and if there's no estrogens in the sample, it's a yellow colour, and basically sewage effluent activates the estrogen receptor, and you get the formation of this red colour, which is a concentration-dependent process, and you can compare the concentration with an estrogen standard. Now, this assay was absolutely great for what we wanted to do, and the kind of process that we did was extract effluent, fractionate it up into many different fractions, and find out which fraction is estrogenic or contains estrogens using this assay. And when we do that, we get a picture like this. Here's the amount of estrogenic activity in the assay. Here are this fractionated sewage effluent. And you can see here three fractions which are highly estrogenic. And so we can use chemical tools called mass spectrometry to take these fractions, these purified fractions, and find out what kinds of estrogenic molecules are in this fractionated effluent. And one of the chemicals we found, not only in the effluent, but also accumulating in fish below effluent, is the pill, or a component of the pill, ethinyl estradiol. This is a picture of a chemical structure. For those of you that are not familiar with chemical structures, it's just a way of looking at a chemical or visualizing a chemical structure. So this is a sort of what a steroid looks like, and particularly what this component of the pill looks like. We also found estradiol. That's a natural hormone excreted by both men and women. And we also found these molecules here. These are estrogens that only come from horses. And you might ask the question, why are we finding horse estrogens in sewage effluent? Well, they're not coming from UK horses. They're coming from a pharmaceutical called Premarin. It's actually used in hormone replacement therapy by UK and European women. And it comes from, it's not a manufactured chemical, it's extracted from horse urine, which these horses are kept in Canadian farms. And the urine is taken out, dewatered, and made into tablets. And I have to say there are rather large animal welfare issues about keeping horses tethered up with urine bags on them for 6 months of the year. And actually the pharmaceutical company that was doing this was Wyeth. It's now been taken over by Pfizer. And they are actually litigating against another company that wants to synthesize what are actually conjugated estrogens. And they've got, quite a nerve to do that, because this involves an animal welfare issue. Anyhow, fortunately, the sales of this pharmaceutical is declining in Britain. But the important point is, in terms of the fish, is that these compounds will feminize male fish at nanograms per litre. Now, a nanogram is 1,000 millionth of a gram. It's an incredibly small amount. And it's very difficult for an analytical chemist to actually quantitate that amount, particularly in the sewage effluent, but certainly in river water. They are certainly extremely potent. And in further work that was done this time by the Centre of Ecology and Hydrology in Wallingford, developed a risk map for estrogens in UK rivers. And they did this by predicting the levels, using modelling work to predict the levels of estrogens present in rivers. And they predicted these levels and based their risk factor on whether they were likely to feminise fish, based on laboratory studies. And what you can see here is that these brown rivers here are at risk for feminization of fish. There are some very small parts which are very difficult to see, which would be very high risk. There's more than 10 nanograms per litre of estrogens in the river. And where you've got less urbanized areas of the country, the rivers are likely to be less of a risk to feminization of fish. So the situation at that time was that the Environment Agency and government are well aware of the problems and risks, but are not asking water companies to do anything about this, to upgrade the sewage treatment works in any way. mainly because it would be a terribly expensive process. It would cost many billions of pounds to upgrade at-risk sewage treatment plants in this country. However, there is going to be a problem in the future because the Water Framework Directive from the EU have decided that they need to control the levels, certainly of the pill component in water, and they are likely to legislate for this in the next few years, and that will create havoc. But moving on from that, the question is, are estrogens the key problem or the only problem? And there is a problem, because at some low or no-risk sites in the modelling data, where the estrogen levels were very low and too low to feminise a fish in laboratory studies, you could still find quite a high incidence of intersex fish. So that raised the question, are there other chemicals that contribute to intersexuality in fish in our rivers? And some work had been done to show that sewage effluents contain high levels of androgen receptor blocking activity and what we call anti-androgens. And this was, in a way, very bad for the environment, but good news for me, because I had a very interesting problem then to work on. What are these anti-androgenic chemicals in sewage effluents? And you can imagine, if a fish, a male fish, is exposed to anti-androgenic chemicals, then its androgens, things like testosterone in its body, are going to be blocked. They won't be able to be active, and so the fish will be demasculinized. If at the same time the fish has also been exposed to estrogenic chemicals, then it really doesn't stand a chance. It's going to be, it's more likely to be feminized and intersex. Right, so how do anti-androgenic chemicals work? Well, here we're back to the diagram of how steroid receptors work. And if we didn't have anti-androgenic chemicals in the organism, in the fish, then androgens such as testosterone bind to the androgen receptor. And that, like the estrogen receptor, then moves to components on different genes, DNA, and the end result is that you get formation of normal male reproductive structures, the sperm-producing cells, and a normal sperm duct. However, if there's anti-androgens in the bloodstream, these will bind also to the androgen receptor. They will stop androgens, normal androgens, binding to the receptor, but they'll also stop the receptor binding to the DNA, and as a result, you will get changes or malformation of normal reproductive structures or the sperm cells. And so we were able to use an assay very similar to the estrogen assay I showed you for based on this kind of mechanism of action, to detect anti-androgens in sewage effluents. And when we do this, this is the kind of profile we get of anti-androgenic activity in a sewage effluent. So here's our anti-androgenic activity on the vertical axis. Here's our fractionated sewage effluent. And you can see that all these fractions here have anti-androgenic activity. This is a very different picture to the estrogenic activity profile I showed you before in sewage effluent. Here we only had about three fractions, which contained about four chemicals that were highly estrogenic. There were lots of other estrogenic chemicals too, but these were the main ones. Here we've got a very complex profile of antiandrogens in the effluent, and also so it's a very similar profile to what we get in fish too, fish that are exposed to sewage effluent. And many of these fractions contain two or three chemicals. So we're talking probably about sort of 80, 90 chemicals. If we go on to, we take those fractions, we put them through a chemical machine called a mass spectrometer, and we identify the structures in those fractions. One of the most important antiandrogens in the effluent and in the fish is something called propiconazole. That's its sort of chemical pattern here. And this is a fungicide that's used on crops in cereals, including oilseed rape, sugar beet, and grassland. Another potent chemical is miconazole. It's an antifungal agent used to control athlete's foot and thrush, so it's used by the human population as a medication. Triclosan. Now, most people have triclosan somewhere in the house. It's a very common antibacterial agent used in toothpaste, soaps, deodorants, mouthwashes. And chlorophene, very common disinfectant used in detergents and cosmetics. So we have a whole variety of different sources of antiandrogens and different structures. There's a lot more. These are perhaps the most important in the effluents and in the fish. Now, we can estimate the potency of these things by comparing their potency with a standard antiandrogen that's used, for instance, in the pharmaceutical industry for control of prostate cancer. Standard antiandrogens would be something like bicalutamide, or we also use flutamide, which is now not used so much as a standard antiandrogen. If we compare the potency of these antiandrogens with the standard pharmaceutical used in antiandrogen therapy, we find that propiconazole is 120 times more potent in in vitro assays than the medical antiandrogen. This is probably one of the most antiandrogenic compounds that we know about. Okay. Miconazole is 40 times more potent, triclosan 5 times more potent, and chlorophene 13 times more potent. So these are some very potent androgen blockers in the environment. Of course, the question we wanted to ask now is, do these compounds contribute to feminization of fish? Now, I'm lucky to have a very good collaboration with Charlie Tyler's team at the University of Exeter. He's a very well-known fish physiologist in the UK. And we were collaborating on this UK research funded grant, and he exposed roach that had just hatched to either antiandrogens or estrogens or mixtures of antiandrogens and estrogens, and he did this for a whole year. And you have to do this for a year because the susceptible window for effects on sexual differentiation or reproductive development on fish is thought to take place very soon after hatching. And he had to expose them for a year so that he got a size of fish that he could actually take the gonads out and do some histology on to decide whether they were a male or female. So this was a major piece of work, and he, his team, found the following results. And for each treatment, these are the different treatments here, there's about 50 fish involved. For the control, the fish that were untreated with either estrogens or antiandrogens, the sex ratio was about 80% males to 20% females. It's a bit skewed, to say the least. It really ought to be 50-50. And we don't know whether this is skewed because the population that came in was skewed in favour of males or whether it was just a chance happening. Then when he exposed to antiandrogens, the sex ratio was about 50-50. So we don't know whether that's a real change in sex ratio or not. But the important point is that he exposed to the component of the pill, ethinyl estradiol, and you got feminization. About 70% of the population was feminized, and about 30% were still males. But if you take that same concentration of estrogen and add environmentally relevant levels of antiandrogens in it, the whole population is female. So that suggested strongly that feminization of male fish in our waters is enhanced by a combination of antiandrogens with estrogen. The environmental authorities are not going to like that result because they're assuming that what needs to be done in future legislation is just concentrating on taking estrogens out of the effluent. If they now have to take out a wide range of structures, including antiandrogens, out of the effluent, that's going to be far more of a challenge. Clearly, these results need to be repeated, and we are in the process of applying for more funding to do that work and confirm these results. However, what is becoming apparent is that antiandrogenic chemicals are widespread in the environment. And there is a concern, because some of those structures I showed you are household agents, triclosan, for instance, and miconazole, there is a concern that humans are exposed to antiandrogenic chemicals and that these chemicals could be a risk to human health. Now, that we know, or there's been a lot of work to suggest that human sperm counts are declining in the Western world. Generally, in some studies taken in the 1930s and 40s, the sperm count or sperm density in millions per mil has been about 100 million per mil, and in more recent studies, it's down to about 60 to 40 million per mil. Now, these studies are very controversial. It's quite difficult to take these measurements accurately. But there is a general perception that sperm counts are declining by about 1 to 2% a year since the Second World War. And the decline is different for certain countries. In North America, it's a very obvious decline, and it appears a steeper decline in Europe, and in some countries there's been less of a decline. At the same time, the problem is that if you get to a very low sperm count of about 20 million per mil, then you're likely to be, it's going to affect male fertility. And it's reckoned that in many European countries, probably about 20% of young men are reaching or sperm counts to this level. In addition, not only are the sperm counts falling, or appear to be falling, but in some countries there's quite a high incidence of abnormal morphology of the sperm. They have two heads and, you know, no tails and that sort of thing. And in Denmark, a high proportion of young men have less than 9% normal spermatozoa. And that sounds like a very poor figure, but actually, apparently, the normal figure for incidence for normal spermatozoa is only about 18%. But clearly this is a problem if we combine or think about sort of declining fertility with the fact that women are having children later on in life and their fertility may be compromised. So this is an added risk factor for fertility. Now, alongside this, there is also, this is widely recognised, that the incidence of testicular cancer in Britain has doubled over 25 years. Gone up from about 3 to 4 cases per 100,000 to about over 7. And this is not just the case in Britain, but it's also the case in many other countries too, a very consistent increase in testicular cancer. And testicular cancer is consistently associated with other reproductive abnormalities in children, certainly in the newborn. Cryptocorticism, which is the undescended testes, the testes don't descend at birth, and hyperspadias, which is abnormal development of the urethra, the opening of the urinary tract. And it is thought that low sperm counts, statistical germ cell cancer, undescended testes, and hyperspadia are linked by a syndrome known as testicular dysgenesis syndrome. And it's thought that they're linked because it's thought that these four factors originate from a lack of androgens in the fetus. Okay? So let's just look at what happens to the fetus during pregnancy. The human fetus in week six of pregnancy is essentially undifferentiated. It hasn't developed into either male or female. If the fetus is a genetic female, it will develop by a default system to a normal female, and no estrogens or hormones are actually needed for normal development. But if it's a genetic male, it needs hormones around about week eight of gestation. It has to have androgens to develop into a normal, a male with a normal reproductive system. It's absolutely compulsory. And if you lower androgens at this time, then in later life, the number of sperm-producing cells are reduced, and you get you can get some of the symptoms of this testicular dysgenesis syndrome. So the thought is that if the fetus has an androgen insufficiency, the male fetus, that you get newborns with undescended testes or hyperspadia, and later on in life, many of these individuals also have low sperm counts or develop germ cell cancer. Now, androgen insufficiency can develop from genetic mutations, but genetic mutations do not account for the incidence of these reproductive abnormalities. They account for some, but not all. But environmental factors are considered important, and of course, the most important environmental factor would be was considered to be exposure of the mother to antiandrogens, which block androgen action. So my job, we got funding from the European Union as a network of collaborators in Europe, was to see if we can detect antiandrogenic chemicals in the placenta of women. And we were lucky to collaborate with a group at the University of Granada in Spain who had placenta samples from a study where mothers had given birth to TDS-affected newborns, i.e. newborns with undescended testes and hyperspadias, what we call the cases, and they were matched with women give birth to healthy newborns. And the problem is that many different compounds can act as antiandrogens. We think of the androgen receptor as being promiscuous. This is a sort of really is a biochemical term for meaning that a receptor can bind to many different chemical structures. And I was brought up when I did a bit of biochemistry at university to believe that hormones interact with their receptors in a very specific and selective way. But apparently that's not true. And things like the androgen receptor acts in a much more non-specific way. It's a bit like the kind of suitcase you have when you go abroad and you've locked it and you get to your hotel and you find that you've lost your keys somewhere. And so you say to a friend who might have a totally different suitcase, oh, by the way, can I borrow your key to see if it'll open my suitcase? And lo and behold, it does. That's happened to me a number of times, actually. It's that kind of receptor. You know, it'll fit most keys. So our problem was, chemically, is that we need to analyse all the contaminants in the placenta. We can't just guess or choose or select one that we think, or one or two or a few that might be antiandrogenic. So analytical chemists usually go this, for what they know could be in a sample, and they like one nice signal for that chemical, and they're very pleased if they get that. This is actually what we call a mass spectrum. It's a mass of a particular chemical. And we call this a known known, because we know what we're after, and we know what we're expecting to get. And of course, there's a well-known person who's coined the phrase known knowns. Now, what we do at Sussex, we do chemical profiling. We analyse everything that we can find in a placenta sample, for instance, and we do this in all kinds of different samples, not just placenta, even if we don't know what it is, okay? And it's an analytical chemist's nightmare. But we don't care. We want to find out what is the whole profile of contaminants in that sample. And we call this known unknowns. We know there's lots of contaminants there, but we don't know what they are. And here's a picture of Donald Rumsfeld, absolutely amazed by the amount of known unknowns we're finding in samples. So we have lots and lots of signals. Some of these are contaminants, some of these are natural metabolites present in the blood or the placenta. We don't care. What we do is use a mathematical model to investigate whether the chemicals from placentas from the case subjects, i.e. the mothers that have given birth to children with, for instance, undescended testes, are different profiles to the mothers giving rise to healthy newborns. So here's our cases in blue, and here's our controls, and these numbers are just the naming or the anonymization of the actual samples. And what you can see is that the cases form a different pattern on this model to the controls. And that suggests that the chemical profiles here, or there are certain chemicals here, which are different or higher compared to certain chemicals in these samples. Each one of these is a sample. When we burrow into this data and look for these contaminants, we find in the placenta compounds used in cosmetics, creams and soaps, sunscreen agents. Here's our old friend triclosan. Remember, that was the antiandrogen we found in fish, very common in household agents, but it was virtually in every placenta sample we analysed. Parabens used in cosmetics. If you pick up virtually any cosmetic, you'll find methyl ethyl propyl paraben in there. Components of plastics, antioxidant agents, and this compound here, bisphenol A, very common component of plastics, of great concern. Pretty well find it in urine of just about every human you analyse. Pesticide products and additives, so pesticide metabolites here, and insecticide. But these were fairly ubiquitous in the placenta samples, but the contaminants that were new, that also were higher in the cases, were these contaminants here. Now, they're unrecognised as environmental contaminants. We don't know really, we're not too sure what their source is, but I think they're present in pine oils. Well, I know they're present in pine oils. And pine oils are used in cosmetic soaps and perfumes and detergent cleaning products. Very similar structures to these are antiandrogenic. They will block the androgen receptor. But because these are not commercially available, we've actually asked a group to synthesise them so we can test them as antiandrogens. So we think they're probably antiandrogens, but we also think they're probably markers of exposure to certain household ingredients, and there may be other chemicals in those ingredients that might be associated with some of these male reproductive abnormalities in the newborn. So we still have some further research to do here. But what is becoming increasingly obvious is that humans are exposed to contaminants from many different sources: food, air, dust, water, soil. And we know that there are about 100,000 man-made chemicals in the environment or currently in use. There's a lot of concern about effects on the male newborn, but there's also now some laboratory work showing that with model animals, showing that some chemicals, exposure to some chemicals in the fetus may lead to obesity and diabetes in the adult. So there are some EU countries who advise women to limit exposure to chemicals such as cosmetics and household ingredients before conception until after the second trimester. And this is a precautionary approach because it's going to take many, many years to determine which are the problem chemicals that we need to reduce exposure to and what are their health effects. And so in the meantime, this precautionary approach is being taken by a number of countries, not the UK. The UK's done very little in this field. Okay, so this business of the alteration of hormonal signalling by chemical contaminants is given a name. It's called endocrine disruption. We think of the endocrine system as a type of hormonal system in our body, but actually this term endocrine disruption is used very loosely to include all kinds of chemicals that have all kinds of effects on disrupting signalling in the human or the vertebrate. And it includes other fish that are exposed to pulp mill effluents, alligators that are have been demasculinized from exposure to organochlorine pesticides, marine snails. There was a huge reduction in the dog whelk population in this country and many countries due to exposure to chemicals used in boat holes, and a decline in vultures in Asia due to feeding on carcasses, both human and animal, that contain high levels of anti-inflammatory medication. Of recent concern is work by the University of Cardiff that have been examining the otter population in Britain. That's made a comeback. It's been introduced after various pollution problems in the 60s. And they've detected undescended testes in the otter population, reduced penis size and sperm duct cysts in these otters. So we're very concerned about our wildlife, or certain wildlife, important indicators of chemically induced disruption of hormonal signalling and the endocrine system in humans. In addition, there are huge numbers, our work now is showing that there's huge numbers of biologically active compounds present in river water alongside the estrogens and antiandrogens I've talked about. These are not properly reduced in the sewage treatment works. You've got a whole range of different anti-clotting pharmaceuticals and blood pressure drugs that are used by people after a stroke. Pain-killing and anti-inflammatory medication is very, very common in river water. Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors and other drugs that alter behaviour. Statins that alter lipid metabolism, antibiotics, and of course caffeine is a diuretic. You can find it in just about every river water sample alongside other compounds that affect urine excretion. So there's a lot of concern that river water is contaminated with lots of biologically active agents. Not only a concern for the fish, but a concern for human exposure, because drinking water comes, of course, from our river water, from reservoirs situated in a river catchment. And also nowadays, with in periods of drought, when the groundwater that's present in what we call the aquifers, when the groundwater is reduced, water companies pump river water down into the groundwater reservoirs for future use later on in a drought period. And so there is, I think, a real concern that some of the drinking water we can drink in the future may actually be contaminated with biologically active compounds. And I hope we never get to the situation where we are contaminating our drinking water. So to conclude this talk, David Attenborough said recently, we've got this extraordinary expertise in destroying, poisoning and knocking down things. In terms of poisoning, it's becoming very clear that certain environments, particularly the aquatic environment, is contaminated with mixtures of chemicals that can affect the fertility and health of wildlife. And the problem is that these chemicals, the health effects of these chemicals may not be noticed for years after initial exposure to a chemical cocktail. For instance, to notice changes in the reproductive system, it takes a few years in a fish, and of course many, many years in terms of cancer and sperm counts in a human. And so, wildlife certainly could be important early warning indicators of human health effects that arise from exposure to mixtures, complex mixtures, of things like endocrine disrupting chemicals. They may not be the same chemicals that fish, that wildlife are exposed to, but they may have the same mechanisms of action, and that's the key point. I think, and many like me think, that future levels of chemical exposure is going to increase, certainly in the aquatic environment, due to climate change. We have more pressure on our water resources. There's going to be less dilution of the effluent getting into the water, into the not only river water, other waters too. And that also there'll be increased levels of medication also getting into the sewage effluent as the human population ages. So this is going to be an increasing problem. We need multidisciplinary scientists to meet these environmental challenges, and universities can play a very important role here, not just in training and educating future scientists, but also perhaps taking a lead on the quality of A-level, school leaver, student that comes into the university. Many students coming in to study a science degree at a UK university come in with just two science A-levels. And for some subjects, just one science A-level. This wasn't the case 20, 30 years ago. And the reason why they do this is that they are concerned about if they study a third science A-level, which might be one of the what is termed a hard A-level, so one in the physical sciences, that they might get a lower grade and might not get to the university of their choice. Now, schools want their students to get high grades. They have league tables that they want to do well in. If universities, and this is controversial, and I'm sure there'll be many that won't agree with me, but if universities moderated the level, that the A-level grade that these students came in, if they took a third physical science A-level, then I think we would ensure that we're getting not only a good quality student, but a student who is not afraid of doing difficult science or doing multidisciplinary science and engaging with a variety of scientific subjects. And that's what's needed to meet these environmental and other scientific challenges. In the same vein, many universities, but not Sussex, have closed certain type science subjects. And this is a huge shame because we need a whole variety of science subjects in our universities to allow postgraduates and faculty to engage with the different disciplines and do cross science subjects. Okay, I want to acknowledge the team that's really helped in the work I've talked to today. And at the top are two people I specifically want to lead. It's Julia Horwood, who's been absolutely fantastic in doing some of the all the assays I talked about, the estrogenic, the anti-androgenic assays, and also making sure we've got really good samples for these assays, good extractions and fractionations. Also, Ali Abdul Sada, who's a very good mass spectrometrist. He's done fantastic work making sure the instruments are technically capable and sensitive to detect some of these things and advise on their analysis. There's a whole gamut of postdocs and PhD students who have been involved in this work and are continuing to be involved in chemical profiling of different environmental samples and tissues, etc. And this is sort of some of the things they get up to, and they've always got a smile on the face when they're out in the environment, sampling muddy environments or at the sewage treatment works, even though it's a pretty smelly place to be, or dipping into the river, going down into the river, or taking samples from sewage effluent, or dissecting lots of fish, and eventually ending up at the mass spectrometer. I have lucky to collaborate with some really excellent people, University of Exeter, Brunel University, University of Granada, at the University of Le Havre, and at the Marine Laboratory. And we've received funding for some of these PhD students from the University of Sussex itself, but also we've had funding for a number of researchers from the research councils and a number of EU organisations or projects, Marie Curie and the Seventh Framework, for example. And thank you for your attention.